Welcome to episode 5 in the fourth season of Justice with John Carpe, the podcast from the Justice Center for Constitutional Freedoms. I'm the show's producer, Kevin Steele, and I'm here with our host, John Carpe, who is the president and founder of the center. Today, John will give us his thoughts and opinions on a book he has previously promised he would review for our audience, entitled Hitler's Justice, The Courts of the Third Reich by Ingo Müller, first published in German in 1987. The English translation by Deborah Lucas Schneider followed in 1991. Just a quick caveat in case you're tempted to rush out and buy the book. The price for a hardcover is listed on Amazon.ca as new $591, used from $109.75. Happily, you can still pick up a paperback for $66. Okay, now, John, tell us about the book.
This book, Hitler's Justice, The Courts of the Third Reich, is fascinating, relevant, and depressing. It is fascinating because history is interesting. It's always very educational to see how other people at other times, what they did, why they did it, what they were thinking, what their motivations were, highly relevant to today, because, you know, listeners of this podcast know that I have warned about soft totalitarianism many, many times, and the breakdown of the rule of law and trampling into the ground of our rights and freedoms. And so the study of history is relevant to the present and depressing because, as we'll, I'm going to go through the whole book in the next, you know, 40 to 60 minutes. And in the aftermath, justice was not served. There's an awful lot of people that were active Nazi judges and lawyers and law professors who, after 1945, they basically continued on working in the Justice Department or teaching law at law faculties, serving on courts, et cetera, et cetera. So the conclusion, according to this author anyway, there are, you know, with history, there are different viewpoints. This is not the only book on the judges in the Third Reich, but this particular author argues very strongly that justice was not served and a lot of very, very guilty people simply continued on after 1945 in positions of influence within the legal system. So that's the depressing part of it. And the contents, I mean, as you'll hear, but let me dive right in.
I was going to say, at these prices, I hope you read the whole thing to us.
that would take a lot more. It would take a lot more than the hour. So the first, he has a prologue, kind of giving some background information on the German legal system, and then he goes through the German legal system from 1933 to 1945. Talks about the Reichstag fire trial. The Reichstag fire is very significant in history because shortly after Hitler took power on January 30th, 1933. On or about February the 27th, somebody, Dutch communist guy, acting alone or with others or whatever, but there was somebody set fire to the Reichstag. And then Hitler decreed a state of emergency, which basically stayed in force for the next 12 years. Because you really need a state of emergency if you want to trample rights and freedoms into the ground. And if you want to take away people's freedoms of conscience and religion and expression and association and peaceful assembly and the right to bodily autonomy and destroy the rule of law. What you need for all of that is an emergency. And so, of course, that's relevant to what Canada and other countries have seen in the last 3 years, where you have this trampling into the ground of our rights and freedoms on the pretext of an emergency. Because if there's no emergency, then it's kind of hard to come up with.
Come up with justification is what you're going to say, I'm sure, because that's all they've done.
It's a lot harder. And so the emergency varies, right? Like we've had bad developments in the law after the terrorist attacks of September the 11th, 2001. And law professor Ryan Alford argues that the United States is no longer a rule of law state because the American president can sentence people to death. He can have people executed without any kind of legal protection whatsoever. But there's a similar pattern there, right? That the emergency is to protect us from jihadist terrorists or other terrorists. So he goes through the courts, the eugenics program, forced sterilization, the euthanasia program, and arbitrary decisions in everyday life. The People's Court, which was an instrument of terror, it was a new court established by Adolf Hitler in addition to, you know, other already existing courts. So instrument of terror. And he talks about the aftermath, coming to terms with the past, and law schools punishing Nazi criminals, jurists on trial, and so on. So the Reichstag fire, the burning of the Reichstag in February, brought in the Reichstag fire decree. And the big thrust of the fear-mongering was about a communist threat. Now, any credible threat, if you want to instill fear in people, if your fear-mongering claims have a kernel of truth or an element of truth, they're much, much more powerful. In fact, if there is absolutely no truth whatsoever, then people wouldn't fall into it. But a clever fear campaign has a component of truth. Now, the Communist Party in Germany in the 1920s was strong. It was the third or fourth largest party. It would have, in a particular election, might have a sixth of the vote or a fifth of the vote. It was powerful political party. The communists had been in power in Russia since 1917. And so a lot of people all over the world, in the United States, Britain, and Germany, everywhere, of course, there were fans and supporters of what the communists were doing in Russia, but there were also lots of people who went, oh, this is bad stuff. You know, they're suppressing rights and freedoms, and they're persecuting and killing religious practitioners, and they're confiscating private property, and so on and so forth. And so there was a large segment of the German population that was very anti-communist, which I would personally agree with that. Like, I'm anti-communist, you know, as well as anti-any, you know. So the Germans were legitimately scared. And if you've got communists in your own parliament who are openly sympathizing with Russia and who are openly saying that, you know, if we get a majority, we're going to impose communism on Germany. And so you have this widespread fear. So the Reichstag fire, so Hitler says it was caused by, it was the communists, and it was part of a plot to take over. And so for the next 12 years, you've got the communist threat. What's interesting is that the author Ingo Müller says that the courts developed a handy rule that all attacks on public and safety and order were to be considered communist in the broadest sense. So the courts came up with more and more variations of the communist threat in order to be able to apply the Reichstag fire decree to all actual or presumed opponents of the Nazis. So, for example, the governor of Münsterland made use of the Reichstag fire decree to ban all church youth group activities. Now, when several members of a Catholic youth organization nonetheless persisted in going on outings and playing sports together, they were charged with violating paragraph 4 of the decree. And the lower court found them not guilty, but the state Supreme Court found them guilty, saying that, quote, this kind of emphasis on religious divisions carries within it by nature the seeds of subversion of the German people, and every such subversion represents a potential furtherance of communist aims and support of the goals of communism. Quite. So here you have an example of a German court that, you know, the law is that the Reichstag fire decree is supposed to be anti-communist, but now you've got a Catholic youth group that
playing sports,
you know, playing sports. And the author, this is quite, I like the way he words it. The author says, since one might think that Catholics were immune to the godless doctrine of communism and even opposed to communism, the court felt compelled to point out the danger inherent in their activities. Quote, such a public display of personal opinion or belief can all too easily become an encouragement to communists, communist sympathizers, or persons currently of unsettled political allegiance, who would then develop and spread the opinion that the National Socialist State did not have the people behind it. And of course, this was very much part of the totalitarian national socialist thinking, is that we've got to have this unity. We're all in this together. And so everybody's got to stand behind the national socialist government. We can't have any dissent because that's dangerous to public health and safety. So using this interpretation of the indirect communist threat, the courts justified actions taken by the authorities against, among others, the Lutheran Confessional Church, opponents of vaccination, a charitable organization called the Home Mission, and so on. But since it was difficult to make it clear to the general population why a communist threat in the broadest sense might be posed by outspoken anti-communists, and also why the supposed danger was not receding with each wave of arrests, the court soon dispensed with mention of the preamble altogether.
It was just understood from that point on, I guess. If you can make that kind of stretch, why bother trying to justify it?
Yeah. So Engelmuller says that in this manner, the courts in National Socialist Germany legitimized the disbanding of organizations, the banning of meetings, the seizure of assets, arrests. And he says that the court's very existence came to be meaningless. By refusing to protect citizens against government regulations, courts gave the police a free hand, while at the same time granting police the sole right to define what was legal. So in a totalitarian state, everything becomes political. And so Ingo Müller summarizes lots and lots and lots of decisions. So one chapter is called Treason and Treachery, Political Opposition in the Courts. And this is crucial here. Judges are to place vital interests of the nation above the law. And later on, we'll get to the debate about the positivist legal doctrine, which is the idea that you just go by the letter of the law and you don't question the morality of the law. Ingo Müller argues that this was falsely put forward after the war as a justification to excuse the judges. But there's so many examples in the book where the judges are not positivists. They don't just go by the letter of the law, but they are deliberately trying to apply national socialist ideology, and they're going outside of the letter of the law. In one county court decision, the judge argued that the national aim and the national emergency should be what triumphs. Every judge is a son of his country and as such must place the vital interests of the nation unconditionally above what is formerly the law. And so the courts in Nazi Germany went along with everything that Hitler did. For example, in 1933, in the month of June, the Hitler regime, having been in power for about 5 months, they banned the Social Democratic Party, which had been one of the largest parties in Germany before Hitler took power, and this matter went before the courts, but the German Supreme Court regarded it as public knowledge that the aims of the Social Democratic Party were treasonable without the slightest evidence ever having been produced. And, this is, of course, a huge problem. When ideology becomes dominant in the minds of judges, whatever that ideology might be, they don't care about evidence anymore. And Ingo Müller cites lots and lots of specific examples, which describes a court case where judges simply jump to conclusions without evidence. All of the activities of the Socialist Workers' Parties were also clearly treasonable in the opinion of the Supreme Court, though no formal evidence was entered. Where the aims of this party were concerned, the court simply took over the routine phrases originally developed for the communists. So communists are bad, and then the courts just kind of jump to the conclusion that the Social Democrats and this other different party, the Socialist Workers' Party, they're just communists.
Well, if I may interrupt just for a moment, the one takeaway that I was able to glean from the reviews of the book, because I didn't see the book, but I did read several reviews of it, the conclusion that I kind of came to is a general one in that it seems that the courts, no matter where they are, seem to be servants of the state, not servants of the people. And that, I think, is the thing that troubles me the most in looking at our situation today and reflecting back on what has happened. You know, the courts seem to serve the state. Is there anything to that? Do you get that sense from this book?
Yeah, absolutely. The lawyers and the judges did Adolf Hitler's bidding. They did not apply the law, honor the law, consider the law. this is not just a German problem from 1933 to 1945. I mean, it's very difficult. You know, in a previous podcast, we talked about Ryan Alford's book, so Canadian law professor, about the development. It took five centuries in Britain to get to the point where there was substantial judicial independence, where judges were not doing the bidding of the king, nor doing the bidding of parliament, but they were truly independent and seeking to apply the law. If you look at the global context of human history over the past 6,000 years and the entire globe, an independent judiciary is an exception. So, I mean, most time periods in history and most, countries, continents, geographical regions, you do not have an independent judiciary. So this is not just interesting historical study that pertains only to Nazi Germany from 1933 to 1945, but it's a relevant issue. He has another chapter on purges at the bar. And quite early on in the Nazi regime, April the 7th, 1933, so Hitler had been in power for less than 3 months, there was the law for restoration of the professional civil service, which expelled large numbers of Jews from the civil service and from the judiciary. Now, just as historical background, according to Ingo Müller, the percentage of Jews in Germany was actually very, very small, unlike Poland and Russia and quite a few other countries where there are large Jewish populations. He says that in 1930, in Germany, the Jewish population was 0.75% only. So less than 1% of the Germans were Jewish. And that the Jews, he says, were also underrepresented in the civil service. They constituted 0.16% of all government employees. So as civil servants, there were not that many Jews. They were actually underrepresented. But the numerous forms of discrimination faced by Jews, including their long exclusion from the civil service, had led them to enter the unrestricted professions so that their numbers among writers, editors, merchants, physicians, and lawyers were in fact significantly greater than their percentage of the total population. So in these professions, writers, editors, merchants, physicians, and lawyers, the Jews were overrepresented. One statistic is that 22%, Ingo Müller says 22% of the lawyers in Germany were Jewish. So huge overrepresentation. Jews were less than 1% of the population, but 22% of the lawyers. In Berlin, the figure stood at 60%. But with the passage of the law for the restoration of the professional civil service, 1,500 Jewish lawyers were effectively expelled from the profession. And the only exceptions, and this is because the aging President von Hindenburg, who was still kind of kicking around in the background and was well-liked and well-regarded. So Hitler was the chancellor exercising power, but this older fellow, President von Hindenburg, was still there. He objected to, he said this was too harsh and too far. So they carved out the only attorneys who were exempted from the Aryan Clause were those who had been admitted to a bar association before August the 8th, 1914. So admitted to the bar prior to the start of World War I, or who had performed military service during the First World War, or who were the fathers or the sons of men killed in war. So there were, and this is interesting, 2,900 Jewish attorneys were able to continue. That tells you a lot about Jews in Germany at that time, that two-thirds of the Jews in Germany had performed military service in World War I, or who had a father or a son killed in World War I. So, I mean, the Jews were patriotic Germans who fought for Germany in World War I. In any event, a third of them were kicked out. Now, unfortunately, this exemption, so the Jews who had served in World War I or had had a family member die for Germany during World War I, they were kicked out later on. In 1938, the Jews were kicked out of the legal profession entirely. This was supported by the Association of German Attorneys. And so the legal profession was dominated by the Nazis. And so when Hitler was busy expelling Jews from the legal profession, a majority of the lawyers supported this, did not object.
That would be like a law society, or is that what you're saying? That it's this organization is like a group of lawyers that band together like a law society? Is that what they sound like to you?
Yeah, that's a good question, Kevin. So not quite like a law society, because today the Law Society of Alberta or any other province regulates admission into the legal profession. So you have to be a member of the Law Society to practice law. What Ingo Müller, the author, says on page 61 is that the regional legal associations, which were organized on a private and voluntary basis, demanded that any remaining Jewish attorneys resign. And the Juristische Wochenschrift, the legal weekly journal, the prestigious publication of the Association of German Attorneys, issued guidelines on publishing policy, announcing that they would continue to print only contributions from persons who are Aryans, and that books written by non-Aryans or published by a non-Aryan publisher would no longer be reviewed. So this sounds more like the Canadian Bar Association rather than the Law Society. So
a national organization. Okay, gotcha. Okay.
Yeah. So we see the lawyers supporting the Nazi ideology. So, for example, the president of the Dresden Bar Association stressed the struggle of, quote, genuine German attorneys, true to the German view of their profession, against the domination of liberal Jewish attitudes in legal life. And so the president of the Dresden Bar Association said that an attorney's duty towards his client is limited by his duties towards society. And he was, in effect, calling for abolition of the profession's freedom and independence. At one point, Adolf Hitler informed the Justice Minister Otto Thierack that the attorney must become a person representing the state, like a judge. By freeing ourselves from the notion of parties to a lawsuit, we free ourselves from the liberal notion of a trial as a conflict of aims, an unleashing of a struggle to find the truth. So this is a breakdown of the adversarial truth-finding process. So the underlying premise in the legal system is the Canadian legal system and American and British and other countries is that whether it's a criminal case, you've got the Crown prosecuting the accused, or whether it's a civil case, plaintiff is suing the defendant for money, whatever kind of court case, there's an adversarial process. Each side puts forward their best possible evidence, and the court seeks the truth. The truth being, did the accused person violate the criminal code and also have a requisite mental element with an intention to do so? Or in a civil case, who's got the strongest evidence? But here what you had in Germany is an abandonment of that notion of the quest for truth, which, of course, logically, that's what you would expect when ideology reigns supreme. Doesn't matter what the ideology is. When you've got an entire society that has jumped to a conclusion and is fixated on a single objective, it's caused by lack of love for truth. And it also, it's like a vicious cycle. It also furthers the lack of love for truth.
Well, one thing that's come up a couple of times in the things that you've read is this notion that the judges are representing the state. And that I don't think is correct, or it shouldn't be correct anyway. Am I hearing that right? They keep arguing that they want the judges to represent the state rather than, say, like in an adversarial situation, the Crown representing the state?
Yeah, that's exactly how it worked for those 12 years, is that the judges chose to be political actors and they cooperated and participated. They did have a slightly different role. So you'd have Hitler and others that would pass these laws, but then the judges would interpret them and enforce them and apply them, but often going far beyond the letter of the law, because the judges saw it as part of their obligation was to advance the principles of National Socialism. We'll probably get to that a bit later in one of the passages. It's interesting that in the People's Court, Specially Selected Defense Counsel, according to Ingo Müller, they frequently delivered speeches against their own clients. An amendment to the attorney's code, according to paragraph 19, the lawyers were required to swear, quote, I swear to remain loyal to Adolf Hitler, the leader of the German nation and people, and conscientiously to fulfill the duties of a German attorney. So that pretty much sums it up in terms of judicial independence. So there's a chapter on Nazi jurisprudence. The April 7th, 1933, law on the restoration of a professional civil service. This resulted in many law profs. Immediately on April the 7th, 1933, 120 of 378 scholars who had been teaching law at German law schools were dismissed. So it was quite the purge, and all those people were replaced by strong adherence to National Socialist ideology. In regards to legal scholarship, quote, "The whole of German law today must be governed solely and exclusively by the spirit of National Socialism. Every interpretation must be an interpretation according to National Socialism." There's a quote here from Goebbels, the propaganda minister, saying that the task of National Socialism was to erase the year 1789 from German history. 1789 sounds to me like a reference to the French Revolution, just the whole idea of individual rights. And so legal scholars began to indulge in polemics against human rights, guarantees of individual rights vis-a-vis the state, limitations on state powers, and restraints on the state's right to impose punishment. So the problem was not just the lawyers and the judges, but the law professors as well got on board and wrote their scholarly legal articles and publications in support of violations of individual rights, saying, well, that's passé. We're now in the modern times, and so we need to abandon this notion of individual rights and freedoms, because we've all got to get on board with National Socialism, which is leading, you know, Germany to this wonderful future.
To the greater good.
The greater good, the public interest, yeah. Safety, security. We got to keep you safe from the communists. And this was, you know, throughout the 12 years, it was always booga, 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 watch out for the communists. And again, there is a kernel of truth in that, insofar as there were real communists who, had they been given the chance, they would have imposed a communist dictatorship on Germany and implemented many of the same policies that, you know, in terms of crushing individual rights and freedoms, the communists were no better and no different from Hitler in that regard. As the author puts it, judges were, quote, liberated, quote, from their obligation to the law, only to be constrained by an incomparably more restrictive obligation to the main principles of the Führer's government, a step which in the last analysis had the effect of making the judge a direct servant of the state. The fundamental principle of no penalty without law sums up several limitations of the state's power to impose punishments. Nothing may be prohibited retroactively. Only an act which was punishable at the time it was committed may be punished. Nothing may be prohibited by analogy. So in other words, only what the wording of the law specifically declares to be punishable is punishable. And nothing may be left unclear. So the statute must be worded precisely and must make it possible to recognize what is a punishable offense and what is not. And finally, the right to impose punishments must be granted exclusively to an independent judiciary, since any system of justice can be undermined if sanctions are permitted to exist outside of it. And of course, so this is in the field of criminal law, and so all of those procedural protections were abolished for the accused. Okay, so again, you cannot prohibit retroactively. Like, somebody did something in 2015, you can't pass a law and say, well, this goes back to 2015. You can't punish retroactively. So that went out the window. Punishing things that are analogous, which is like, well, the law prohibits such and such, you know, he did something similar, it wasn't the same thing, but by analogy, we're just going to punish him. Okay, that's a prohibition there was tossed out the window and so forth. So Ingo Müller argues that for this reason, laws under National Socialism were formulated purposely in vague and fuzzy wording. General provisos, admission of analogy, recognition of healthy popular opinion as a source of law. This comes up again and again and again, is that people get convicted and sentenced to death. And one of the things that's referenced as a source of law is healthy popular opinion.
Who's referencing that? Sorry.
The judges in their court ruling, judges in their court rulings, they reference healthy popular opinion as a source of law to render their verdict.
That would be like a consensus. Perhaps a scientific consensus. Yeah.
Well, yeah, that's analogous to, yeah, oh yeah, there's a very strong scientific consensus. So therefore, we don't really need to look at the evidence because we know that there's this great consensus. So therefore, on the basis of this consensus, we can just make our rulings. So we don't really need to actually take a hard look at any of the evidence because, you know, there's this consensus. So this kind of thinking is very dangerous and obviously is not limited only to Germany under the National Socialists from 1933 to 1945. So the courts were quite active in assisting the Hitler regime in crushing dissent. So the dissenters, of course, the biggest groups were the communists and the social democrats were strong opponents of Hitler as well. A number of Christians, too few in my view, and certainly at the grassroots level, more so than at the level of leaderships. Neither the Catholic bishops nor the Protestant church leaders in the higher echelons were outspoken opponents of the Nazi regime. But the courts went along and political opponents were branded as particularly reprehensible criminals. Quote, "For the enemy of the state and the community of the Volk, there's only one course in prosecution and sentencing, unflinching severity and, if necessary, total annihilation. The criminal law of the Nazi era was characterized by categories of wrongdoing based on vague and feudalistic moral values such as honor, loyalty, and duty." So again, this is dangerous. If you have platitudes like, quote, the public interest, quote, if it's not specifically defined, that's very dangerous for individual rights and freedoms when courts start relying on vague terms. So the author has a short chapter on how civil servants became the Führer's political troops. He has a chapter on the creation of concentration camps. Of course, the interesting detail there is that they were set up in 1933 and initially were used for Germans. They were used to imprison communists, social democrats, and Christians, or, you know, pro-democracy, classical liberal, just any opponents of the regime. Protecting the race is something that he has a chapter on that, and a lot of this is a lot of case law on the pro. It became illegal for Jews and Aryans to marry each other, and so there's a lot of court rulings about who was or who was not a Jew, and that was quite complicated. But one National Socialist scholar declared that the most important task of legal policy is the struggle against racial dishonor since, quote, law originates in the racial soul of the people it governs. And there's one similarity here that I just cannot help but notice, and I will talk about it. The Nazis believe that race defines you, and this is exactly the same thing that the social justice warriors and the equity, diversity, inclusion crowd, they also believe that race defines you. There's that commonality there. They don't care about you as an individual with your own background and your own thinking and your own personality, but there's this big fixation on race. And so everything that matters is the skin color matters a great deal. And so that's a similarity.
Correct me if I'm wrong, but didn't you say or quote there that race not only defines the person, but it also seems to define the law here as well? When he talked about it, define it, the soul of the nation defining the law, that seems to be along the same lines anyway.
Yeah. Well, the author quotes at page 94, County Court of Köln in German, and states, quote, "The race to which a person belongs is among his chief personal characteristics." So in other words, I see this polar opposites as, on the one side, the view that I would adhere to is that, yes, skin color is a reality and, you know, different people have different skin colors, but it isn't or should not be the central defining characteristic of who you are or the chief personal characteristics. And so you've got the Nazis saying that race is the chief personal characteristic. It really, really matters a lot. Everything's about race. And then you've got people today in 2023. And when you hear them talk, it's like everything is about race, you know, to hell with our other aspects of our humanity. Like, maybe did you grow up in a loving home with loving parents? What kind of a character do you have? Are you a virtuous person? Are you honest? Are you courageous? Are you compassionate? Are you charitable? It's like, no, none of that matters. Like, everything's about race. And so we see that today in 2023, that, you know, if you're obsessed with race and skin color as the number one feature of what defines you as a human being, then unfortunately you have a belief similar to what the Nazis believed.
Yeah, the problem though is when it sort of gets codified into the law, because I suppose the thing that I see as problematic is that when it gets codified into the law, it then kind of negates the whole concept of the rule of law or equality before the law, which to me is the rule of law, right? It applies to everybody.
Well, I agree with you. It's problematic when you have race-based laws. It's a breakdown of the rule of law, because then you get different laws for different people depending on your – another quote the author has here, page 95, the Court of Appeals in Karlsruhe stated, quote, "Today it has been recognized that the Jewish race differs considerably from the Aryan race with regard to blood, character, personality, and view of life, and that a connection and pairing with a member of this race is not only undesirable for members of the Aryan race, but also injurious and unnatural," end of quote. So the author points out that in applying the law, the courts under National Socialism took into account the existence of racial differences recognized by the state through passage of the Aryan laws. So none of the lawyers or judges in Nazi Germany took exception to this or opposed this. They all went along with it.
Well, I suppose some of them went along with it just out of fear, though. I mean, it wasn't a matter of them accepting the logic of it or the illogic of it. A lot of them were probably afraid as they sort of went down that slippery slope, you know, and things accelerated towards World War. You know, they just probably became afraid for their lives.
I think that was part and parcel of it. And of course, this is something that the Allied powers after 1945, as well as the German people themselves, have had to grapple with. You know, to what extent are you not responsible because you're going along with something because you're afraid? For example, in the judge's trial, where there are 16 German lawyers and judges were tried. So this is part of the Nuremberg trials, and some of these judges had just sentenced so many people to death on spurious, specious grounds. And do you then say, well, they're all excused because they were all afraid? I'll get to this a bit later, but there's only one judge in Germany who actually did not cooperate with the Nazis, and he spoke out against it. He was removed from the bench, and he was not executed.
Right. Okay.
And so that's interesting. There are two other judges who were executed by the Nazis, but that was because they had participated or had known about or had been actively involved with the plot to kill Adolf Hitler in 1944, which was almost successful. The bomb went off, and the briefcase with the bomb in it had been put in a slightly wrong place. If it had been put in a different place, it would have killed Hitler. But in any event, there were two judges. There were quite a few people involved in that plot. It was a big plot. So the two judges were found to have been part of that conspiracy. So they were executed by the Nazis, but they were not executed on the basis of having opposed the Nazi laws or failed to apply the Nazi laws. It was their participation in the plot to kill Adolf Hitler. So according to this author, Ingo Müller, there was only one judge in Germany who did not go along with this, who did not cooperate. And it's interesting, he was not executed. He was, you know, put into retirement. So another chapter is on the courts and eugenics, July 14th, 1933. The law for the prevention of hereditary diseases, which provided for mandatory sterilization in cases of genetic disorders. Now, lest we get all morally self-righteous about this topic.
Yes.
Here in Alberta, we had sterilization laws on the books into the 1970s. And there are many people, I don't know if it's hundreds or thousands or tens of thousands, but many people were sterilized in Canada. Would not surprise me if similar laws were on the books in other provinces. I just happen to know that in Alberta, sterilization laws were on the books until the 1970s.
Eugenics were very popular. Yeah, of course. Yeah. Infamously, Tommy Douglas was a in favor of eugenics as well. So, I mean, it was a popular position to take back in the 30s.
Yeah. So according to the first paragraph of this German law for the prevention of hereditary diseases, persons suffering from hereditary diseases were to be sterilized if, quote, the experience of medical science, quote, suggested with great probability that any offspring of such persons would have grave physical or mental defects. So here you see this appeal to science. This is not new for this is throughout the Nazis did it, and but we did it for eugenics as well. Well, this is scientific. When you persuade people that something is scientific, it's a really good way to reduce opposition, because people equate science with truth, and you say, well, this is science, right? It's kind of a way of saying, well, this is true. So you have to go along with it because it's the truth, because it's science. So declared as genetic diseases were feeble-mindedness, schizophrenia, manic depression, epilepsy, hereditary blindness and deafness, severe physical deformities, and severe alcoholism. Application for sterilization could be made by the person affected or by a legal guardian, medical officer, or head of a mental hospital. Law professor Carl Binding co-authored the book Sanction for Destroying Lives Not Worth Living, and he dismissed the possibility of misdiagnosis as of no great concern. Quote, for family members, the loss is naturally very severe, but the human race loses so many members to errors that one more or less hardly matters, end of quote.
Yes, but here we see part of the problem is the devaluing of human life, right? You know, or the devaluing of the individual.
Of individuals.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's like you've got this vague, fuzzy, feel-good notion about society, and that gets used as the pretext or the excuse to kill people, because if the individual life is not valuable and is not protected by law, everybody's in trouble. If all you have left over is some, you know, vague notion of the public interest or society, that can be the pretext. So according to the author, the judges were only too glad to defer to the, quote, expertise of Nazi medicine.
And there was, of course, infamously the Nuremberg doctor's trials as well, which received a lot more attention than the lawyer's trials.
And from which comes the Nuremberg Code, right, which was stems from the court rulings condemning the National Socialist doctors for having engaged in experiments on patients or on people without their full and informed consent. So the author at page 123, he cites an example of where the courts are not necessarily following the letter of the law. This seems to be one of the central arguments of the book, because the excuse that was made after the Second World War is that, well, all of these German lawyers and judges, they were positivists. So they were trained to simply apply the law unthinkingly, unquestioningly, without considering whether the law itself might be wrong or unjust. So they were all legal positivists. And so here's an example where they're not just rigidly applying the law according to the letter of the law, but they're taking liberties with it to kind of achieve an ideological perspective. So the Hereditary Health Court of Laich in East Prussia ordered the sterilization of a young woman, even though her deaf mutism had resulted from two accidents and a severe ear infection, and the fact that she had given birth to a normal baby argued against the presence of a genetic disorder. In its decision, July the 15th, 1937, the court observed, quote, although no further cases of deafness can be documented among blood relations, nevertheless, the Hereditary Health Court is convinced on the basis of the medical specialist's opinion that it must be a case of hereditary deafness. After sterilization has been successfully performed, this woman may marry the father of her child, the deaf-mute tailor, once he has also been sterilized. The vagueness of psychiatrists' expert opinions and the nonchalance with which facts were determined come to light in decisions that involve distinguishing between schizophrenia and other forms of mental illness. A 40-year-old architect, father of two healthy children, had been taken to a psychiatric hospital following a suicide attempt. The court concluded that the mental illness is either schizophrenia or manic depression, A precise diagnostic distinction is not necessary, however, since both disorders are hereditary disorders under the meaning of paragraph 1 of the Law for the Prevention of Hereditary Diseases. Both of the medical experts who testified had argued strongly against sterilization because the patient was, quote, a highly estimable person with very valuable intellectual and affective qualities and of high character, and such hereditary traits deserve to be spared, end of quote. This did not help the architect's cause, however, since the court objected that the presence of valuable hereditary traits alone does not justify a rejection of sterilization. And so the Court of Appeals said that this 41-year-old was to be sterilized and says the issue is, quote, it must be taken into account that the aim of the law is not to protect him, but to guarantee the future of the German people, end of quote.
Okay.
So there you have it again. You have this collective, it's all about, you know, die Volk, or I don't know if it's die Der or das, but the Volk, it's the people. Everything's about the people. And again, you have that same kind of sick thinking is prevalent in other time periods in history, including our own. That same twisted thinking that the individual doesn't matter because everything's about society. Everything's about the public interest.
Yes, and ironic, of course, that they used communism as the bugaboo when they are behaving in such a collectivist way.
Yeah, well, the differences between Adolf Hitler and Joseph Stalin are superficial insofar as they have a different ideology. Stalin is all about creating heaven on earth known as the workers' paradise. Hitler wants to create heaven on earth with the thousand-year German Reich, where the Germans are the master race and they rule the world. So they both have they have different visions of what is the utopia. But in practice, in terms of what they do, they both believe that you can murder millions of people to try to build heaven on earth. And so there's an underlying similarity, even though superficially the differences between national socialism and international socialism, you know, are quite vivid and they're not the same thing at all. But you've got this underlying disrespect, disregard for human rights. The author talks about the euthanasia program, defenders of the law, Supreme Court as the Court of Appeals. A decree entitled Extraordinary Measures Related to Broadcasting had made it a crime punishable by a penitentiary sentence to listen to foreign radio stations. The act of passing on foreign news, which was likely to threaten the capacity of the German people to resist, was even a capital crime. And of course, what we had here, of course, is courts applying that law without any qualms and doing so not necessarily according to the letter of the law, but always to advance the principles of National Socialism. So ideology came first. A chapter on arbitrary decisions in everyday life, the author states that the readiness of the courts to bow to the wishes of their political masters was not limited to criminal cases and the discriminatory race laws. In all areas of the law and in all kinds of courts, genuine or presumed opponents of the regime were deprived of their legal rights. So, for example, the Hamburg County Court took custody of children away from Jehovah's Witnesses because the religious education that they were receiving endangered the children's intellectual and spiritual welfare in the extreme. So here we have ideology leading to parents that are not, you know, they're not beating their kids, they're not depriving them of food, they're not depriving them medicine, the kids are fed and clothed and there's no neglect and there's no abuse. But the Jehovah's Witnesses, their doctrine obviously very different from Nazi doctrine in very many different ways. So take the kids away from the Jehovah's Witnesses because, you know, they were particularly, I guess, not non-compliant with Nazi policies. I don't pretend to know that much about the Jehovah's Witnesses, but my understanding is that they will not stand for the national anthem. They will not stand up. And so part of their religious belief is this very strict avoidance of paying honor to the state. I mean, I'm sure they pay their taxes, but when the national anthem is sung, the Jehovah's Witnesses will sit down. They won't stand up because in order to love God, you shouldn't show any kind of respect. They don't vote in elections. So you could see the Jehovah's Witness is not doing well in a national socialist state, because a totalitarian regime, by definition, by nature, wants everybody to speak out and affirm and show support. You can't just be, you know, this quiet, neutral objector who quietly disagrees, right? Everybody's going to come out. And I mean, it was mandatory by law to do a Hitler salute and to greet somebody with the words Heil Hitler instead of, you know, good morning, good afternoon, hello. The first words out of your mouth when you met another person was to say Heil Hitler and put your arm up in the air. That was a law. You could see the Jehovah's Witnesses not going along with that.
Right. You know? Yeah.
The Petty Court of Ulster put into a state home all children whose fathers had not sent them to join the Hitler Youth, since, quote, anyone keeping his children out of the Hitler Youth is abusing his parental authority, end of quote. Pastor was found guilty of requesting prayer for somebody that had been detained in prison. There's a chapter on the People's Court, which was, again, a new court set up by the Hitler regime. An example here, while on a concert tour, the Dutch pianist Carl Robert Creighton stayed in Berlin with a longtime friend of his mother's, and this friend of his mother's was an ardent National Socialist. During a meal at her house, where only the two of them were present, the Dutch pianist Creighton made some derogatory remarks about the Hitler regime. In order to provoke his mother's friend, he called Hitler brutal, sick, and insane, and predicted that the war and the Nazi era would soon be over. For this, he was accused of giving aid and comfort to the enemy and undermining morale, and he was tried before the People's Court. The court condemned him to death on September 3rd, 1943, on the following grounds. Whoever acts as Creighton did is doing precisely as our enemies would wish. He becomes their henchman in their war of nerves against the steadfastness of our people. Even the presence of obvious contradictions in its own reasoning did not appear to bother the court. The main thing was to arrive at a death sentence one way or the other. Carl Robert Creighton was executed during the night of September 7th, 8th, 1943. And another quote from this court ruling, Creighton's action is a scurrilous attack on the confidence of a member of the German nation. He thereby publicly attacked our ability to defend ourselves manfully in our fateful struggle. Publicly, because everyone must reckon with the fact that German citizens who hear something like this will report it to the authorities of the state or the party, and publicly, because our National Socialist Reich wishes every citizen to concern himself with politics, and because every political remark represents a part of the fundamental political thought of our nation, end of quote. And so here again, you've got a court that is saying, so this private conversation between this professional concert pianist and this woman, private conversation is public. Everything is public in a totalitarian state. So the author goes on to say, this is at page 165, the wartime laws and decrees, already extremely severe to begin with, became brutal instruments of oppression in Poland through their broad and undifferentiated application. One instance is a decree of the Führer issued on December 23rd, 1941, the decree to protect the collection of winter clothing for the front. It provided the death penalty for anyone misusing the collection for personal profit. The decree did specify that the crime had to be committed with intent. A 23-year-old Polish waitress named Anna Zagarska, described by her German employer as completely trustworthy, clean, and hardworking, was given a secondhand fur jacket in January 1942 by a friend in the German army. The soldier had taken the jacket from the stores of the winter collection, a fact of which Anna Zagarska knew nothing, as the court itself later acknowledged. So the court knows that the law says that the crime had to be committed with intent, right? The crime of, you know, taking the winter clothing, which of course the Germans were doing poorly, not being as good at handling the Russian winters as the Russians were, and so let's get the clothes out to the front. So the court knew that Anna Zagarska did not know that this fur coat was wrongfully taken from stores. She was unaware of the existence of both the winter collections and the drastic penalties in the decree concerning them. When she heard about them 10 days after receiving the present, she became concerned about where the fur might have come from and packed up the jacket again in order to give it back. Before she could return it, however, she was arrested, tried before the special court of Turin, and sentenced to death for violating the criminal regulations concerning Poles in connection with the Führer's decree to protect the collection of winter clothing for the front. The decision in the case, reached by three trained jurists, consists of several pages of legal argumentation of the most outrageous kind. In the opinion of the court, it was not necessary for the defendant to have knowingly removed an article of clothing from the winter donations in order for her to be found guilty. But rather, on general principles, it sufficed for there to have been a limited attempt to commit the deeds. So, there we are. Another example, Special Court of Prague sentenced to death a 63-year-old Catholic priest named Karl Kretina, who had been accused of making malicious remarks. Kretina had said an illegal mass for the soul of a Czech condemned to death and executed by the special court. He had also preached on several occasions against violence and godlessness and had told a church sexton that Jews were being tortured in Theresienstadt. He was guillotined on January 16th, 1945. There's a short chapter, Resistance from the Bench. I alluded to this earlier. Two prominent judges were, in fact, executed for resistance during the Third Reich, but both men paid with their lives for their participation in the plot against Hitler. It is a matter of record that neither judge was persecuted for professional conduct. Now, the only exception was a Dr. Lothar Kreisig, a judge at the Court of Guardianship in the town of Brandenburg on the Havel River. Kreisig had committed numerous minor acts of insubordination, such as departing early from a ceremony in his court when a bust of Hitler was being unveiled. Kreisig had protested publicly against the suspension of three judges after the passage of the law for the restoration of the professional civil service. And at one point, he had distributed leaflets for the confessional church. So this is the German Protestant church that did not cooperate with Hitler. There was the Reichskirche, the state church, which was basically subordinate to the Nazi regime. And then there was the confessing church, which was the non-Nazis. So this judge was with that confessing church. A formal investigation was begun with the aim of removing him from the bench after he referred to Nazi church policies as, quote, injustice masquerading in the form of law. When Kreisig learned that inmates were being secretly removed from the mental hospital in Brandenburg-Gorden and killed, he sent a letter about these occurrences to the president of the Prussian Supreme Court, asking for clarification and advice. Kreisig's case is extremely revealing. It shows that if a judge refused to accept the injustices of the system, the worst he had to fear was early retirement. So it's interesting. He was removed from the bench, but he was not imprisoned or tortured or executed. The author says at page 196, he said, "The degree to which the judiciary became a smoothly functioning part of the National Socialist system of intimidation becomes clearer when one looks at the number of death sentences passed." And of course, that's that sticky, thorny issue post-war, right? If you're sentencing people to death unjustly as a judge, to what extent, if any, can you say, you know, well, I was scared and I feared for my own life. 80,000 Germans were executed, and those were all, those 80,000 were passed, death sentences passed by the court. To show the difference between a totalitarian regime like Adolf Hitler's and a arguably non-totalitarian fascist dictatorship, that of Mussolini in Italy, the author says that the special tribunal established in fascist Italy in 1926, which in personnel and procedures more closely resembled a military court, handed down only 29 death sentences and 7 sentences of life imprisonment. So you get 80,000 Germans executed and 29 Italians executed.
Did they give the period for the Italian court? Because you started it, I think, in the 20s. So did they give an upper limit? Like, did it go to the end of the war?
Well, presumably, yes. Okay. Yeah, so it's even more of a disparity, you know, because Mussolini came to power a lot earlier, but before Hitler did.
Right.
So now the third and final chapter is called The Aftermath. Okay, this is the depressing part of the book because justice is not served. The long and short of this final chapter of the book, and I'll reference a few passages here and there, but what it boils down to is that active Nazis, even Nazi party members, members of the SS, which were kind of the Nazi elite that were particularly nasty and evil in all that they did. Most people, they got their jobs back in the civil service. They continued to teach in law schools. They worked for the, they were civil servants in the justice ministry. They were judges. They were lawyers, law professors, the whole kit and caboodle. The vast majority of Nazi supporters after 1945, within the legal profession, simply continued on as they had pre-war. And this is where this author, Ingo Müller, he says it's not true that they are excused because of the positivist legal doctrine. He said this is a popular notion, and he talks about, you know, people that promoted this and why it may have become popular. He argues that it's false. And some of the examples that we've referred to so far shows that, like, no, it wasn't just that you had these unjust Nazi laws and then the judges just simply applied the law that was passed by the legislators. The judges went beyond the requirements of the law and sought to implement the doctrines of National Socialism. So here is here's a depressing example. Franz Schlegelberger, who was acting Minister of Justice under the Nazi regime, he was sentenced to life imprisonment, but he was released in 1951 for health reasons, died in 1970. So the last 19 years of his life. Now, he was paid a monthly pension of 2,894 marks, mark being the German currency, in addition to 160,000 marks in back pension, at a time when a skilled worker was earning about 400 marks per month. Okay, so skilled worker earns 400 marks per month, and this Nazi criminal is getting 2,894 marks after spending 5 or 6 years in prison, being released for health reasons. I don't get the whole rationale. I don't know why you can't get medical treatment in prison and simply stay in prison, but I don't know the details. So the author says that the legal profession began by denying categorically that German judges had participated at all in the injustices of the Hitler dictatorship. Hubert Schorn, for example, whose book Judges in the Third Reich is one long justification, yet still a standard work today, ascribes all guilt to the lawmakers. He sees the fact that jurists following the existing legislation as a result of their, quote, positivistic training, end of quote. So legal positivism, with its demand that judges be strictly bound to the law, had been the unchallenged doctrine of the authoritarian state under the Kaiser. The author goes on to say, placing the judiciary under a strict obligation to follow the letter of the law would have been an impediment to the legal order of the Nazi regime and would have limited its power. For this reason, judges were required to declare their loyalty to the Führer, Adolf Hitler, rather than to the law itself. By the way, we talked earlier about the law for the prevention of hereditary diseases that led to the sterilization of approximately 350,000 people. And according to the author, it took until 1979 for the West German parliament, the Bundestag, to reach the conclusion that forced sterilization was irreconcilable with the concept of human dignity. So sounds like there too, like in Alberta and presumably other Canadian provinces, it wasn't until the 1970s that we figured out that forced sterilization is not compatible with human dignity. Law schools, the Nazis had dismissed almost one-third of all professors, and these were all replaced by strong national socialists. But then the author says that by the 1950s, only 17% of the full professors dismissed by the Nazis were ever recalled to their former positions. And the, you know, the argument the universities used to, you know, keep all their Nazi profs there and not hire back the law profs that were dismissed by Nazi laws, academic freedom and the independence of the university. Really? That's what the university said. Yeah, we don't have to, We don't have to hire back those anti-Nazi law profs that were dismissed in 1933. We don't have to hire those people back. We don't have to fire any of our Nazi personnel because the independence of the university is sacrosanct. How dare the state interfere with the university and tell us what to do? So,
okay. That's quite a stretch as well. I'll tell you one thing that all this does is it makes me reconsider my opposition to the idea of legislating from the bench. Because if judges can legislate from the bench, it shows agency there. And because they can do that, then they are accountable for what they do. They can't use the positivistic argument anymore because they have the ability to override the law or the written law.
Yeah, I hear you. There's a chapter on punishing Nazi criminals. This is very depressing. I'm going to mention just one case. Alois Häfele, a former SS officer who had participated in the killing of more than 89,000 people in Kulmhof Chomo death camp, had helped to organize the camp, had supervised the cleaning and maintenance of the gas vans, and had personally pushed the victims into them. He had stripped the dead of their valuables for personal profit and had received 800 marks and special leave from Heinrich Himmler, of course, leading senior Nazi, as a reward. For all this, the Bonn County Court had classified him as a mere accomplice without the intentions of a perpetrator. So he was found to be only an accomplice, and it's not clear from my reading whether he was acquitted outright or only suffered a minor consequence. But there's no death sentence or life imprisonment for Alois Häfele. Another example, Karl Wolf, an SS general who had functioned as Himmler's personal liaison officer at Hitler's headquarters and had shared responsibility for the murder of millions. Even though the court itself was convinced that Wolf viewed Himmler's instructions to kill Jews as necessary and correct and approved his aims in carrying out this allegedly historic mission, the court took the view that the decisive factor for distinguishing between a perpetrator and an accomplice is his personal attitude toward the crime. So, again, somebody is seen as an accomplice rather than an actual perpetrator, this Karl Wolf person. The French historian Alfred Grosser has pointed out that a list of the absurd arguments used in trials of Nazi criminals would be endless. Quote, sometimes murder and systemic torture are excusable because the defendant acted in a frenzy of anti-Semitism and the guilt lies with those who trained him to think that way. At other times, the fact that he acted in cold blood mitigates his guilt precisely because he did not act in a frenzy, but was merely obeying orders from above. So, I mean, excuses made.
Yeah, hopefully no precedents being set.
So here's another depressing example. Bruno Streckenbach was in charge of planning the mass murders in Poland and the Soviet Union. The Russians had sentenced him to 25 years of hard labor. He was deported to West Germany in 1955, but the authorities there did not begin investigating him until 1957. The investigation was closed after only a short time, but then reopened in 1961 in response to international protests. Streckenbach was arrested, but was released from prison after only 4 months on medical advice. The Office of Public Prosecutions opened yet another investigation in the course of which a single prosecutor took depositions from more than 100 witnesses and filled 30,000 sheets of paper with information. The pretrial investigation lasted from 1970 to 1973, and when the indictment was ready, filling 512 pages and accusing him of causing the deaths of at least 1 million people, Streckenbach, now 72 years old, called in sick. He was suffering from coronary insufficiency and poor circulation, not unusual ailments at his age. A physician at a Hamburg hospital certified that his fitness to stand trial was therefore limited, meaning that the proceedings would have to be interrupted several times a day to let him rest. A Hamburg county court then found that a trial in this form would be irreconcilable with the defendant's human dignity. Proceedings were ended for good on April 30th, 1974. And so on. So there you've got this Bruno Streckenbach, evidence suggesting he's responsible for causing the deaths of a million people, but because, oh my, he's got some health problems at the age of 72 and spends no time in prison.
Well, they were a little late in starting to recognize again the rights of the individual, but seems a little too subjective for me.
Reparations for victims. That's another short, depressing chapter. The author mentioned, and of course this would have been in 1987, he says, quote, even today the reparation for 1 year in a concentration camp is a single payment of 1,800 marks, German marks. So that was in 1987. So, I mean, $3,000, $4,000, $5,000 Canadian dollars in 2023 is my rough estimate. Jurists on trial. Okay, now this is interesting. So part of the Nuremberg trials, so here are Josef Altstötel, chief of the Civil Law and Procedure Division of the Ministry of Justice. Paul Barnickel, senior public prosecutor of the People's Court. Hermann Kuhorst, chief justice of the Special Court. Karl Engert, chief of the Penal Administrative Division in the Ministry of Justice. Gunther Joel, legal advisor and chief prosecutor of the Ministry of Justice. Herbert Klemm, state secretary in the Ministry of Justice. Ernst Lautz, chief public prosecutor of the People's Court. Hans Petersen, chief justice of the First Senate. Franz Schlegelberger, state secretary and later acting minister of justice. He's the one referred to earlier, sentenced to life imprisonment, released in 1951 for health reasons, died in 1970. So some of these people got life sentences. Others got prison terms less than life. Some were acquitted. The main charges against the jurists were judicial murder and other atrocities, which they committed by destroying law and justice in Germany and by then utilizing the empty forms of legal process for persecution, enslavement, and extermination on a vast scale. The defense argument was that, and Schlegelberger in particular, his defense counsel said that he had remained at his post to prevent the worst from happening. This was rejected by the court, fortunately, and this is interesting. The court says, Schlegelberger presented an interesting defense. He feared that if he were to resign, a worse man would take his place, and says that there's some truth to that claim, that somebody worse would have taken his place. Upon analysis, this plausible claim of the defense squares neither with the truth, logic, or the circumstances. Schlegelberger and other defendants who joined in this claim of justification took over the dirty work which the leaders of the state demanded and employed the Ministry of Justice as a means for destroying the Jewish and Polish populations, terrorizing the inhabitants of occupied countries, and wiping out political opposition at home. So here we have at least some justice. If you're a fan of capital punishment, you would say that it was unjust that none of these people were executed, that at worst they got a sentence to life imprisonment.
But there was recognition legally that these were crimes. I guess that's some satisfaction there.
But the author says, still, this had little effect on the German legal profession, which tended to dismiss the Nuremberg trials as pure retribution on the part of the victors. So again, this is one historian's opinion. There's other historians would argue that people were brought to justice and that there has been a, you know, greater recognition by the German legal profession of what the problems were. So the last third of the book is thoroughly depressing because, according to this author, the Nazis were, by and large, were not brought to justice. And in particular, the lawyers, the judges, the law professors, the civil servants in the Justice Department, by and large, even the fervent and fanatical and committed Nazis, they just continued on their merry way after 1945. Now, the author says at page 295, I'm going to read a short paragraph, and that will conclude my book review. Quote, above and beyond this sort of justification for participation in the crimes of the Third Reich, certain of Hitler's derogatory remarks about the legal profession continued to be cited in its defense. It is true that Hitler took a dim view of lawyers and had no use for treaties or statutes, let alone a constitution. Hitler did not even like his own decrees to limit his complete freedom of action. Hitler detested lawyers as pen pushers who filled whole volumes with tangled commands and prohibitions and always had their noses buried in ridiculous tomes. Hitler once confided to a gathering of confidants that going to law school must turn every rational person into a complete idiot, and that for his part, he would do everything he could to make people despise a legal education, end of quote. Now, not surprising that Hitler would hate lawyers if the lawyers are standing up for the rule of law. Lawyers are supposed to be an impediment to the likes of Hitler and Stalin, but I could see how some people would abuse Hitler's dislike of lawyers as some kind of a suggestion that lawyers in Germany from 1933 to 1945, the suggestion that lawyers were opposed to Hitler, this author provides a lot of evidence to suggest that they were not and they were enthusiastic supporters. So on that depressing note, I would recommend the book as reading. Again, as I said at the outset, it is fascinating, relevant, but heads up, very depressing.
Thanks a lot, John. That was fascinating. Okay, with that, we'll call an end to episode 5 in the 4th season of Justice with John Carpe. Thanks a lot, John, and I look forward to speaking to you soon.
Thanks, Kevin.